the chance to present these results, I think this is probably the right place to do this. So I'm really happy I have the chance to do it here. So let me just give you a brief reminder of what black hole thermodynamics means. So in the late 60s, early 70s, people started to realize that there is a parallel between the black hole physics and thermodynamics. And this parallel is very well summarized by these four laws that one can write down for black holes, which mimic very closely the law of thermodynamics. And in particular, this law suggests that there is an analogy between the entropy of the area of a black hole and the notion of entropy. And at the same time, there is a notion of temperature given by the surface gravity of the black hole. And just from this first law, it's this correspondence is up to a constant. But the main problem at the time was that even though there's this analogy, black holes were expected to be black, so they were not supposed to meet and to have temperature. So at the first time, this thing wasn't taken too seriously. But then Hawking showed that indeed the black hole emit and they have a thermal emission of particles. It, in fact, showed that temperature goes as the surface gravity of the horizon. And this gives best a relation of the entropy as area over 4. So this is a classical result of 74. And what it's telling us is that black holes have an entropy and they evaporate. So now the natural questions are, which is the origin of this entropy? Which are the degrees of freedom accounting for this entropy? And what's the dynamic of the black hole evaporation? So now the next two slides, I will try to convince you that there is one needs the theory of quantum gravity to answer these questions. And the reason is that, well, first of all, so what is the entropy? The entropy, Boltzmann teaches us, is the number of internal degrees of freedom of a system given macroscopic parameter. And if one takes, for example, black hole of a solar mass, this number is huge. It's 10 to the 10 to the 77. So the question is, where do this huge number of degrees of freedom live? Classically, well one guess would be the horizon areas, since the horizon, since the entropy scales as the area. But classically, this is forbidden, because the Noether theorem tells us that there is basically only a few parameters which can characterize the horizon, the black hole, which, and so only the area can characterize the macroscopic state of the horizon. So this would be a logarithm of 1, which gives 0. So the next guess is in the bulk, because in this case, the classical geometry would be unaffected by all these different macrostates living in the bulk and possibly close to the singularity. But then a more serious problem somehow arises if one takes this road, because so let's look at what the Hawking radiation is. So the Hawking radiation is basically is a calculation of quantum field theory on a curve fixed background. And it says that the black hole radiates as a thermal object, which in particular means that the spectrum is, doesn't have any information of the structure of the body that collapsed to form a black hole. That's why the quanta of the radiation are mixed with partners which are inside the black hole, and there are correlation between degrees of freedom outside and inside the black hole. And so so far, so good, but what happens when the black hole evaporates completely? At this point, basically, one remains with a state which is mixed, but there is no partner left anymore. So all the correlations are somehow gone. And there is so the evolution led from initial pure state to a mixed state, a fundamental way mixed state, because there's no partner left anymore. So this is somehow a contradiction of a combination of GR quantum mechanics, which leads to non-unitary evolution of black hole. Moreover, one would ask, would like to know what happened to the degrees of freedom that collapsed inside black hole, formed the black hole. What about then, the information going into those radiation? So it seems like one has to provide a... If you believe in the singularity theorem, then everything will disappear once the black hole completely evaporates. Yeah, I mean, if you take the same classical analysis, this is the picture. Of course, that's the point. So that's why you need a quantum treatment of the gradation degrees of freedom to get out of this paradox somehow. And the hope is that if one provides this description, the macroscopic degrees of freedom, of the quantum gradation degrees of freedom, one can account for the entropy, at the same time use the dynamic of the theory to describe the evaporation process and try to see what happens to these degrees of freedom. So the main idea is basically is to interpret the Beckett-Hawking entropy in a weak way. That is, this is a point of view which was championed by many people. I believe the first one was Beckett, and then other people, some of them present here, pointed out this push for this point of view, which is that the entropy in the first law is really the log of the number of states which somehow you can encode the information that you can read from the horizon, on the horizon, and then can affect the exterior. So this means that somehow the horizon carries some information, and there is a density of approximately 1 bit per unit area. So one can picture the black hole as formed by tiny Planck scale cells, and each of them carries a bit of information, or 2 bits of information. So what this bit of information represents then depends on the deep structure of space-time. Okay? At this point, I think there is an analogy with condensed matter can help to understand this point of view. So, but in condensed, if you take a dilute gas, the situation is not far that's that different. So, in this case, the deep structure is given by the atomic structure of the gas, of the matter. Okay? And the entropy is linear with the number of molecules. And is this, so it's this finiteness of the number of atoms that gives a finite answer for the entropy. So one can imagine the quantum horizon to behave somehow as a gas of particles. So in this case, the role of the molecules of the gas would be played by the constituents of the quantum space. And the finite answer will come from the fundamental discreteness at the Planck scale of space, of quantum space. Okay, so let's try to make this concept more rigorous. So in FQG, the first ideas about black hole entropy start with the works of Krasnov, Rovelli, and Smolin, where basically they somehow the idea was that the boundary, the states of the quantum horizon are related to some topological quantum states, and one can associate the finite statistical ensemble given by the area of the horizon and counting the quantum states compatible with this with the area. So this led to a local definition of black hole, which is encoding the notion of isolated horizon, which allowed the application of FQG technique to this portion of space-time. And this led to a description in which the quantum black hole is basically described by HR-Simon theory on a puncture true sphere. So the idea is that there is the true sphere, and there are punctures coming from the bulk, which are the puncture that carries the degrees of freedom of quantum space. And then, basically, the dimension of this Hilbert space in HR-Simon theory is isomorphic to is the same as the dimension of the Hilbert space of SQ2 in intertwiner due to the area constraint. So basically, one can associate the Beckett degrees of freedom to the quantum shapes of the horizon. And there's actually a classical, semi-classical limit in which this SQ2 quantum intertwiner represents some surfaces, which are tessellated surfaces. So the degrees of freedom are the polymer-like excitation gradational field. And if one counts the dimension of this Hilbert space, find that the answer is linear with the area. And by introducing the temperature of the horizon by hand, somehow by assuming that the near horizon geometry is a Schwarzschild, one can recover the 1/4 without fixing any missing parameter. Plus, there is an extra term, which is somehow a quantum correction to this formula, and depends on the number of punctures. And I will come back to this extra term, because it's going to reappear later and comment more on this. But so this was the story up to May 2012. Then Eugenio introduce a new piece to this story. So Eugenio applied the spin form formalism to study the entropy of horizons, linear horizons. The idea is to use spin networks as the SLHC representations, which satisfy the simplicity constraint and define a boundary Hilbert space by taking a surface, tessellating the surface in phases, and to each phase associating one of these representation, one of this state, and then take the tensor product of this object. Then he uses the Boussard-Hamiltonian operator, which is the generator of the quantum Rinder horizon, and define the Bessel Rinder horizon by evolving this state using this Hamiltonian, this Boussard Hamiltonian. And if one uses this state, one can compute the expectation value of the energy and finds that this goes exactly as area over 8 pi gl, where L, 1 over L is the acceleration of the observer close to the horizon. And moreover, if you couple the two-level detector, you can see from the ratio of equilibrium population, you see that this quantum horizon thermalizes and with the temperature, which is exactly the Urey temperature. So what he did was to use the classical relation to relate the variation of the entropy to the variation of the energy and find that this gives the variation of the entropy is equal to the variation of the area over 4. Then in, well, this is not published yet, but in presenting these things at the International Quantum Mechanics Seminar, it gives a statistical mechanical interpretation of this result by defining a partition function for this boundary state and showing that the variation of the entanglement entropy of this given by this partition function satisfy this relation here. So the interpretation, the statistical interpretation in this case is not the number of microstates compared with the macro parameter, but is the entanglement of the quantum gradation degrees of freedom. Notice that this is a relation of the variation of entropy to the variation of the area. Okay? So I will try to say more possibly about the relation between these two pictures. Just want to give you this idea that there are two somehow description in LQG of Bekele entropy, and it's very much likely that there is a relation between the two, and one can have the other where the other has problems somehow. But I'll say something more about this later. So now back to the evaporation process. What is this? Sorry. Between degrees of freedom leaving, for example, on a link of a spin network outside and the degrees of freedom link inside. Yes, and that's what that's why I'm taking, first of all, the weak interpretation point of view of the entropy of the black hole, meaning that I interpret the entropy in which the Bekele entropy only to the degrees of freedom leaving on the boundary, okay? Not what goes inside the black hole. Because if you count those degrees of freedom, it's most likely that the answer you get is an infinite answer. You won't get A over 4. So if you take this point of view, the information paradox, solving the information paradox will mean recovering the information leaving on the horizon, not the information, all the information that fell inside the black hole. But this will become clear as I go on. So, well, okay, so I'm not saying that I'm taking a point of view of entanglement entropy here. I just wanted to present the state of art somehow. Like, this is a picture that has been enriched by this component very lately. And I think that still there is a lot to understand about this interpretation and also the relation with the canonical picture somehow. But there will be a role of entanglement entropy in the evaporation process for sure. And I believe that this characterization of the entropy given by Eugenio is important for at least for to derive a second law for this process, the evaporation process I'm going to describe. But from now on, I will assume the point of view that the entropy is related to the quantum fluctuation of the geometry. And the information that I want to recover is the information of the quantum geometry of the boundary. But I will come back to this. Okay, so the strategy is, what is the strategy? The strategy is to describe the evaporation process by introducing a perturbation of the equilibrium configuration given by the isolated horizon. And the way to do this is to implement some interaction between the dynamic in the bulk and the boundary state. And so going out of equilibrium and then until for so a small perturbation, the horizon becomes dynamical, and then you still have an equilibrium configuration again. So the way to do this, though, is you need to deparameterize the system near the horizon. And this means that you have to locally to single out a partial observable that plays the role of time that will allow you to describe the Hamiltonian operator as an evolution operator for the boundary quantum geometry, so that you can define somehow an evolution of this quantum state on the boundary. And the idea is to use the formalism of a dynamical horizon developed by this people, for example, with the local thermodynamical description provided recently by Frode and Gosch and Peretz. So to be more specific, well, okay, so let me give you first the general picture, what I want to do. So again, using an analogy with condensed matter, with, in particular of the Marian motion, using the fluctuation dissipation theorem, basically one can interpret the Einstein relation as the first example of the fluctuation dissipation theorem. This relation provided the first proof of the atomic theory of matter. Then this idea was somehow applied to black hole physics by Shum and Candelas, who studied the thermodynamics of dissipative processes associated with black hole physics. And these reversible processes are based on the Onsager principle that tells you that a system, when it's in a given configuration, it doesn't matter if you reach this configuration by an external perturbation or by spontaneous fluctuation. So I want to apply the same principle to a dynamical horizon and interpret the first law of dynamical horizon as a fluctuation dissipation theorem. And through this interpretation, I will be able to derive a radiation spectrum and argue that if I will be able to observe this radiation spectrum, then this will provide a proof of the atomic structure of quantum space. So this is the general framework I will try to follow. Now, just let me go through very quickly through the Brownian motion derivation, just because I think there are a lot of analogies with the black hole evaporation that I'm going to describe. So the derivation of Brownian motion basically has two parts. There's the first part in which one described as a stochastic process. In particular, one described the displacement of the particle in terms of probability theory. This allows you to write a diffusion equation for the density of baryon particles and relate the diffusion coefficients to the mean square of this displacement. Then the next step is to relate this diffusion coefficient to other physical measurable quantities. And this is where the fluctuation dissipation theory enters. Because assuming the equipartition law and the Stokes' law for a force acting on the Brownian particle, which basically relate the mobility to the viscosity of the fluid and the particle radius, one can write a Langevin equation for the equation of motion of the particle, in which the force acting on the particle has two components. There is a frictional force, and there is a random force, which is the force that drives the Brownian motion is given by the thermal fluctuations of the solvent on the particle. And if one then uses the Wiener-Kindschein theorem, which basically relate the amplitude of the Fourier mode of the process to the correlation function of the process, one can relate this mobility to the fluctuation of the velocity of the particle. So there is this is the dissipative part, this is the fluctuating part. So this is the first. This is a fluctuation dissipation theorem. And if now one combines the two parts, basically one can relate the diffusion coefficient to quantities that once measured provided a proof of the atomic theory because allow you to derive the Avogadro number, to measure the Avogadro number. So there is a link between the macroscopic and the macroscopic level description given by this interpretation of fluctuation dissipation theorem. Now, let's try to do the same with black holes. So what is the idea behind? The idea is, okay, if I introduce a perturbation of the metric on the horizon, encoded, for example, in the shear, I know there is a ratio telling me this induces a dissipation of the area of the horizon. In part, an example of this is if you have a non-axis very slowly varying gravitational field produced by a distant mass. This induces a perturbation on the horizon, and this perturbation is dissipated away by producing gravitational radiation. Now, Kandersa and Sharma use interpret this relation as a fluctuation distribution theorem. What they did was to compute the spectrum of the fluctuation of the shear operator, and using the Onsager principle that tells you that either you perturb the object from an external perturbation, or this object fluctuates spontaneously, the result is the same somehow. So you know that if there are fluctuations of the shear, the black hole must produce Hawking radiation. And they show that the spectrum of this operator is exactly the black body spectrum with the temperature given by the surface gravity over 2 pi. So they reproduce the Hawking radiation using this interpretation of the perturbation of the horizon geometry metric. Okay, so let's try to apply this to isolated horizon and dynamic horizon. So in one well-known problem of isolated horizon is that there is no unique notion of energy for the isolated horizon. In particular, one can always rescale the Killing vector field with respect to which you define the energy, and consequently, as a consequence, the energy gets rescaled. So what Frodenberg and parents found is that if you go local, close to the horizon, you can actually provide a unique notion of energy given by the area of the horizon. In particular, they showed that for an observer which is hovering close to the horizon, basically there is a notion of energy that if you throw a particle of force inside from infinity, they see a variation of the energy which is related to the area. A variation of the area of the horizon. And this provides a unique notion of energy that you can use in the quantum theory, because now you can have a quantum notion of energy by using the area operator that you have in quantum gravity. And you know that the quantum boundary state is an eigenstate of this operator. So this allows you to write a partition function, which is written here. And where, yeah, so I'm in a Grand Canonical Ensemble, so there is a chemical potential, because I want to allow the number of particles to vary, basically. So from this partition function, then I can compute all my thermodynamical quantities. And so now the next thing I need is the dynamic horizon framework. So in dynamic horizon, one can write a first law, a physical process of the first law, by starting from the scalar constraint of gravity. And what these people show is that, so if you impose the Hamiltonian constraint for the portion of isolated horizon, so for a dynamic horizon, so a dynamic horizon is basically is a space-like surface such that the expansion of one of the two null norma, k, is equal to zero, and the expansion of the other one, n, is negative. So this is, in this case, is dynamical. Then you reach a isolated horizon configuration when both the expansion are equal to zero, and the horizon becomes an null surface. So they show that, so the Hamiltonian constraint can be written this way, where there is a term which gives you the variation of the area in terms of the radial component, and then there is the flux somehow of the gravitational energy which is encoded in the shear of the horizon. Now, this, as I was saying before, there's an ambiguity here, which is related to the fact that I can always choose a different function of the radial component, and this will rescale my surface gravity and also my Killing field with respect to which I define energy. So somehow, this is represent an ambiguity in the description of the systems, which I want to solve by imposing the condition that at equilibrium, My surface gravity is the same surface gravity that I have for an observer which hovers around the horizon and is stationary. And this can be achieved by simply choosing for f the proper distance of the observer from the horizon. This corresponds to going to the gauge in which the lapse is equal to 1, and is exactly the reference frame in which it's the render frame, basically. Yeah. So this is a condition that I impose. I'm assuming there is a very quick dynamical phase, and then I have again equilibrium configurations. So I'm imposing this condition on the equilibrium configuration when the horizon is isolated. It's a space-like distance. It's a proper distance which is space-like.
If you were going through a bifurcation surface of the horizon, then there'd be a well-defined distance. But that's apparently not what you're doing.
So I'm,
you have a null surface and you have observer a point off of it.
I am, yeah, I'm a, it's an accelerated observer outside the horizon, which is
zero.
Yeah, it's so, yeah, I mean, I'm going locally. Assuming it's, I'm going to render frame local or in the frame outside the outside the horizon.
Yeah.
Well, for each point on our surface, I can. Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming that. Yes, but okay, this dynamical field, this is an approximation up to order L. Okay, so there is a very quick dynamical phase during which my surface gravity doesn't change. Okay, so and what this is a ratio that I impose when I'm on the equilibrium configuration, right, during the dynamical phase. So there's a dynamical phase, then equilibrium again, and that's where I impose this condition, this notion of a proper distance. Yeah, so there is.
The distance that it would be if you continued that equilibrium.
Yes, yes, exactly.
You had a global
going. Exactly.
Then you could solve the distance to the
bifurcation. Yes, exactly. Here, it's, everything is spherical symmetric here. Everything is spherical symmetric.
In the dynamical horizon context, if you have spherical symmetry, you don't have sigma.
Yeah, this is.
You can have both.
No, okay. I will say this is a condition that I define when I'm in equilibrium. Okay, this is a dynamical phase which is like a perturbation. So this is a gauge fixing that I do when I'm I am at equilibrium without perturbation.
But in dynamic horizon, you know, you get a perturbation, then
it's span. Yeah.
No reason the horizon is perfectly symmetric. Because the gravitational wave is not.
Yeah, well, this perturbation radiates away and it reaches spherical symmetry again. So it radiates the perturbation away and it reaches spherical symmetry again.
Oh, but in the dynamic horizon, there's no radiation.
No, no, there is a radiation. There's a, of course, there is a radiation. You can. This is a formula for the gravitational radiation. If you have math, there is another piece here, which would be. Yeah.
But after, I don't think there's any current that the horizon is spherical. Because the shape, which is determined by the whole history of what can be coming.
Yeah, so I'm assuming, okay, the horizon forms, becomes a spherical symmetric, then I perturbe it a bit, it radiates with the perturbation.
So it's an
ideal horizon, not spherical. No, no, he's assuming that there is a spherical symmetry to start with.
No, I return to be spherical.
I think you're assuming it's always spherical up to a small perturbation.
Yes, yes. Yes.
It's close enough to spherical so that you can still.
Yeah, besides, in the quantum. Besides, in the quantum theory, all these notions, spherical, symmetric, and perturbation will become a bit more fuzzy. So this is.
There's a tension because the small perturbation you're thinking about is the frequency of the square that you're trying to track. So you neglect it,
No, but if I understand it, then it's not neglected. It vanishes before some time. It's a small time when it's not zero and vanishes after that.
Yes, but the horizon, the dynamic horizon has no reason to be spherical symmetry.
He says, Laurent, he's assuming a case where it is.
It cannot be.
I mean, in the quantum theory, all
the surface symmetry cannot be linear because there's never any perturbation. So,
spherical symmetry is a small perturbation where there is perturbation and then a spherical symmetry again after the.
No, I'm sorry, I studied the work of Ashtikar and Benjamin Spheres. It's just that's not their definition. You're talking about some other theory of black holes, which is not what they're doing, where these things are proven.
I mean, as soon as you switch sigma equals zero, as soon as sigma is equal to zero, this object is spherical again. It can be spherical. It's a straight horizon, so it can be spherical.
No, it has multiple. I don't know. I'm sorry. It just depends on. No.
It can be also distorted, but that.
Yeah, it is. In
yeah. Okay.
I thought it's a physical understanding that a black hole will radiate quickly all its multiple moments except the dipole.
I know, but that's not. You're talking about the event horizon. He's talking about dynamic horizon. Even the horizon never moves, so you cannot do that.
Look, the thing is, I can also assume, I can quantize a straight horizon which are not spherical symmetric, so it doesn't matter really for the quantum theory.
But I guess all this discussion is that, you know, dynamic horizons are good because you don't have to assume spherical, you know, you get most of the first hole and second hole without assuming killing vectors and spherical symmetry. This is, and then you have, you know, dissipation, which is the key. But once you are there, you have to give up spherical symmetry and killing vectors. And so you cannot have both good worlds. I mean,
no, well, spherical.
You make your choice. Either you know, In the dynamic horizon context, you give up that notion. It's not necessary to do anything you used to do. That's all. That's all I'm saying.
But so maybe we should go on.
Yes, I think. Yeah. So then, you know, that's his question. If you give up spherical symmetry and killing vectors, then this notion of distance is not.
No, but you can always define. You can always define a killing vector field. A notion of energy or Killing vector field somehow for.
You can, but there's this issue that you're talking about, which is the normalization.
Yeah. But that's why.
Which is not, you cannot fix.
No, I can fix when I'm in equilibrium. When there is no shear, I can fix it.
Mm-hmm. Is the goal here to describe the evolution of the sequence of equilibrium states? And that's why we want to do this?
Sorry?
Is the goal here to describe
yes.
So, I mean, this is like no different than squishing a balloon and describing the gas inside is in equilibrium at each moment.
Yeah.
So I agree that any moment you're squishing the balloon, of course, it's not exactly the equilibrium that you're squishing, but if you do it slowly enough and it samples rapidly enough, aren't you roughly?
It's fine. I'm saying you can be at equilibrium, but the multiple momenta doesn't have to vanish. So your balloon at equilibrium, it's plastic. It could have a, you know, bean shape.
So what happens
at the end?
There are no multiple moments.
That's a different definition. That's not dynamic horizon.
Maybe the question is, what's the status of the physical status of this dynamic horizon? In particular, I suppose it must be a theorem or something that when the event horizon returns to equilibrium, dynamical horizon coincides with the event horizon. Is that true?
No, only at plus infinity. It's theoretical.
So then there's a series.
No, they never agree.
This argument assumes that when the dipole in the normal sense of the word, by which I mean the event horizon, had settled back down to spherical symmetry, I thought the assumption was that, I thought you said that this
is isolated horizon here.
And that's not the same as.
Because it can coincide. It's not.
It doesn't
necessarily have to because it's not a global notion. That's right, horizon. It's defined locally.
It doesn't. You know, it's just different notion. It's a variable of
physics. What? By saying that the expansion of the now normals are zero.
But you can probably.
This is enough to prove the first law. Yes.
If you have spherical symmetry, yes. But in general context, no.
No,
that's the whole point. So if you assume killing vector and spherical symmetry, then you agree.
But that's not necessary.
You can talk about all the laws of physics or black hole physics without assuming these two things. No killing vectors, no spherical symmetry, but everything survives.
There is a local killing vector. There is no global killing vector, but there is a local.
If there is a multiple moment.
No, yeah, but if there is spherical symmetry, there is a local notion.
Maybe we should go on. Laurent, you had a great talk to give us about how we can.
No, this is not me. This is Ashtika and Krishna.
Okay.
Okay.
No, they can do talk. It's established.
Are you worried doing evolution along time? What's time evolution along a space-like surface?
Yeah, that's why I'm.
That seems, what?
That's why I'm trying to deparameterize the system, and to define a notion of a time variable here that I can use.
But I'm not just worried about the normalization of the time, but the fact that time is flowing.
Yeah, here the time is given by the radial distance, if you want, like how close you are from the horizon. That's the notion of time I would use here.
Is that okay? I mean, it just seems worrisome because.
Well, you know.
Time should normally be in a time like direction.
Yeah, but I can. If I want to say the expansion of. If I want to say the expansion of the horizon, I can see the study expansion by see how closer I get to the horizon. Somehow, so the more the horizon expands, the closer I get. So that's a measure of time somehow.
Okay.
Evolution. So in the quantum theory, then I can write the Hamiltonian constraint as a term which is basically the conjugate moment of this variable I've chosen as time, plus the shear operator, which is I will use as a perturbation. Okay. Now I go to the Heisenberg picture, and I want to study the dissipation rate of the energy, but these states are the boundary quantum states, using this Hamiltonian constraint, which basically gives me the relation of between the matrix element of the Hamiltonian constraint, the dissipation rate in terms of the matrix element of the Hamiltonian constraint. So the picture is that, and the quantum theory. So my quantum boundary state, it's for example, there is a vertex, there are two punctures that goes inside the black hole. Okay. Now, when I act with the Hamiltonian constraint, what it does, it creates a puncture a new link between these two punctures, and it lets the two spins that go through the black hole change the spin. So this is the kind of fluctuation of geometry that my perturbation introduce. And this will change the quantum state. I will reach a different quantum state for my boundary state. And I want to study the dissipation of the energy of the horizon by studying the matrix element of these kind of actions. So the idea is that now if I interpret this action in terms of fluctuation dissipation theorem, then I see that the action of the Hamiltonian operator is what gives the fluctuation of the geometry, and the dissipation comes in due to the spectrum, the form of the spectrum of the area operator. And this leads to evaporation of the black hole, basically. Now I can write an analog of the Fermi golden rule for this radiation spectrum, where I have this is the expectation number of puncture with a given spin, and this is with the other spin that I showed before. This is the matrix element of the Hamiltonian operator, and then there is the energy of the single transition. And P and Q are the spins of my initial state, mm-hmm. which will jump to P plus minus 1/2 and Q plus minus 1/2. Okay. In particular, for example, if Q is 1/2, for example, here I jump to 1/2, 1/2, so this becomes 0, and so one puncture disappears from my boundary state. And the spectrum, so it's given by the expectation numbers of punctures or a given spin, which I compute from my partition function that I wrote before, the matrix element, which have been computed for the Euclidean part of the Hamiltonian constraint, times the energy of the transition.
And S bar i,
these are the expectation number for number of punctures of a given spin. So this is the
number of punctures.
Yeah. It gives me basically the combinatorial factor for the transition.
Where is this delta EQ
coming from? That is the energy, the intensity of the transition. So the jump of the energy from the initial state to the final state.
And which energy do you take?
I take this notional energy given by the area. So because when I jump, I change the spin, I change the area of my horizon. So I compute the area of my initial configuration minus the area of the final configuration. This is going to give me the intensity, the energy jump of my horizon. So there is a power 2 which comes from the fact that when I compute the commutator of H and E, there is a H times the delta E of the transition. And then there is the delta E simply, which is the intensity of the transition. So the power one power 2 comes from the commutator. So it's a part of the probabilities, if you want.
Square.
The square, yeah. Delta E square. There is a delta E square, which... Because the probability transition is the matrix element of H times delta E. So when I square this to get the probability, I get matrix element of H square times delta E square times delta E, which is the intensity of the transition.
It's for the same reason there's a big
Yeah.
That's just a kinematic, that's just state counting. That's phase space or something.
It's the degeneracy of the phase space, yeah. But he has my theorem because it's the enters the probability of the transition.
Now important so is how important yeah. is this position value of H? Is it the one?
It's no sorry, when
does the plot change a lot if you put it to one as position value?
It does, because in particular the shape change. So this somehow you see this
so
that
where is plot there?
Sorry?
Where is the plot?
Okay, so these are the lines where I consider the action of H on one node.
Where is the axis?
The axis, so X is given by beta, the temperature, times the energy of the transition. This is delta E. Sorry, I should. This would be, this is delta E, it's not delta plus minus.
Just a question about the transition. You change P and Q both by plus 1/2 or minus 1/2, or you just change?
I consider all the possible transitions. Well,
okay, so I mean, these are essentially all the possible UN operators.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So some of them could be plus minus or plus plus.
Yes, yes. The thing is that, that's the point. So you could jump, you can increase the area or you could decrease the area. But the area spectrum is such that when you jump, for example, minus 1/2, the change of the energy is bigger than when you jump to plus 1/2. Because you see, you know that the area spectrum is not equispaced. So this, for example, you see, if I start with a spin 1/2 and I jump down, this gap here is bigger than if I jump up.
So it depends on which area spectrum you
choose. Yes, I'm choosing the square root of jj plus 1.
And if you choose the equal number, the un 1?
In that case,
does that change qualitatively what you're going to say?
Well, then it's not obvious that you have a dissipative effect in that case. Here it is obvious. So that's why I'm saying that the dissipation is really given by the spectrum of the area, and the fluctuation part is given by the action of H. But the form of these matrix elements somehow give you change the envelope, if you want, of the spectrum, and it's such that because these numbers are much smaller than one. So somehow it kills the transition involving more than one node. That's why a priori you could have transition involving more than one node, that this will add lines to your spectrum. So there is a broadening of the lines, and you might not distinguish the discrete structure. Okay, but the fact that these numbers are very small is such that if you're close enough to the horizon, so that you don't see your punctures, but just a part of them, these probably are the most intense lines that you will observe. Only if you go far away, you will have more lines in your spectrum. And there will be a coarse graining somehow of these lines, of the spectrum.
Can you explain again the axis?
So the axis is just the temperature beta times the energy of the line, the delta E.
And then where is the vertical axis?
So I put it by hand.
So because up till now, the mass of the black hole takes no role?
No.
Where is the vertical axis?
The vertical axis is this times beta.
but just to come back to it, so far you're using the Gauss Alejandro definition of energy, but doesn't know about the mass of the black hole. And so you don't know that this process accumulates to a temperature knowing anything about the mass of the black hole. You put that in by hand.
Well, I'm assuming that what I'm assuming is that the temperature goes at like the surface gravity. And the surface gravity also doesn't depend on the mass of the black hole.
The surface gravity came into this discussion about what's the time variable, what's
normal. No, the surface gravity enters the formula of the energy. What the formula they derive for the energy is area times the surface gravity. And the surface gravity doesn't depend on the mass. It only depends on the proper distance from the horizon, the acceleration of the observer.
Okay.
So the assumption here is basically the temperature also scale as the surface gravity somehow.
So this is the temperature as seen by this
New Horizon, yes. Yes.
It's not the temperature that we normally attribute to the black hole. This is something that's blowing, diverging as you're going.
Yes, yes.
So in particular, the wavelengths associated with these are of order of Planck scale when you're on the order of Planck scale hovering over the black hole.
Yes. The intensity of those lines are, yeah.
But this scale. So, okay. I have more questions later. So this is not related to the Hawking radiation.
No. I mean, this is not Hawking radiation, of course. It's a completely different thing. In particular, yes, it's. That's why those lines, they don't get smeared somehow.
So
as you would expect.
I is the, sorry, it's an intensity of something.
You mean this I here?
Yes.
Yeah, is this intensity here?
What does it represent, the intensity of what?
It's the intensity of the line, of my transition, of the emission line.
Normally in the golden rule, it means the probability per unit time
to have the
transition.
Yes.
Is that how we can interpret it here?
Yes.
Where time is this particular
yes.
thing that you've defined?
Yes.
Can you explain the shape of the spectrum? Where
so these are the lines. Okay, so the first two set of lines are given by when one of the two punctures. So, okay, the emission is always one. The puncture with the lower spin jumps down, and the puncture with the higher spin can either jump high, up or down. Okay, so the first set of two lines is when the puncture with the higher spin jumps up, and the second two lines is when they both jump down. And yeah, then the different lines are these different lines here are because the amplitude depends also on the spin of the puncture that you have on this area. But these are they cannot be as big as you want because if you have here the intertwining. So okay, one thing is that the puncture can only have small spins. So basically, I consider transition only where the puncture goes up to spin one or spin 3/2, basically. And so the same applies for the R, basically. So I consider all the possible R that you can have if you consider this kind of puncture on the horizon.
So do I understand your diagram right? You say you have four lines because each spin can go up and down?
Yes.
And then the broadening is just that you're averaging over the intertwining spin?
Yes, exactly. Okay, so some comments. One thing that one can hope is that if eventually one would be able to observe this spectrum, then some ambiguities about the quantization of constant will be solved because, in particular, the spectrum will depend on the representation that you choose for the curvature, for example, and also on some ordering. Like if you choose a different ordering, some set of lines disappear, for example. And then a more important comment now is, so this dissipative effect has been considered in by these people here in the argument, thermodynamical argument to derive general relativity introduced by Jacobson. And what they did was to show that you can still run this argument if you want to incorporate the shear in your congruence of geodesics, as long as you consider non-equilibrium processes. These non-equilibrium processes are related to dissipative processes, which force you to introduce in the Clausius relation a term of entropy production, which is an internal entropy production term, which is related to the excitation of the macroscopic gravitational degrees of freedom. And in particular, they show that the viscous work that you have to do on this macroscopic gravitational degrees of freedom it's what compensates somehow, encodes the macroscopic effect of the rise on shear. And this is exactly the term that you have, the extra term that you have somehow in the area law that I was mentioning before. It's a term which is related to the excitation of the macroscopic degrees of freedom at the rhizome in a process which is out of equilibrium. So my understanding of this extra term somehow is that this extra term has to be related to a non-equilibrium process related to the evaporation of the rhizome, which encodes the dissipative effect which leads to evaporation of the rhizome. So the way to interpret this, the most obvious way to interpret this for me, is to interpret this as entanglement entropy, entanglement between the quantum of radiation that has been emitted and the puncture that it's been, for example, eaten by the black hole during this process. And this first of all, this provides a microscopic interpretation of this coarse graining action of the Hamiltonian operator, which can be used in a hydrodynamic approach to study the continuum limit of the theory, for example. I will say a bit more about this later, but and also this can provide a connection between this entropy, the interpretation given by Eugenio, or related to the entanglement of the degrees of freedom of the rhizome. But I will come back to this, I think, later. Now, so what about the information paradox? So the usual argument is that if one assumes nice sliced conditions, given local Hamiltonian evolution, and the fact that her theorem tells you that there is no information living on the rhizome, then there is a violation of quantum unitarity. Now, so what is the assumption that I'm going to give up here? The assumption I'm going to give is that the rhizome is not information free. There is information in the rhizome which is encoded in a quantum hair. And the quantum hair is given by this spin living on the punctures of the rhizome, which encodes the geometry of the rhizome. And at this point, I think it could be useful to an analogy with the notion of quantum, which has been introduced in the early 90s by these people here. In that case, the idea was that even though you cannot have a hair classically, you can have a quantum hair if you, for example, you start with a continuum gauge symmetry and you break down this symmetry, for example, and you get a discrete symmetry. In this case, the theory has a solution, for example, a cosmic string. And this cosmic string, the scattering of this cosmic string with a black hole, can be used to detect the charge associated with this discrete symmetry that you have on the rhizome. And so it can encode some information, which is not classical. It's a quantum charge. And they show, for example, that the temperature of the rhizome, if it has this charge, is cooler than if it doesn't have this charge. And also there is an argument by Moss that if black holes have this kind of charge, then there would be a non-perturbative correction to the area law. So why this is similar to what we have in the quantum horizon in the LQG? Because if you start with the quantization of said horizon, basically the fundamental equation that you have is this one here that relates the curvature of the connection on the horizon to the flux of the electric field. And Salman and Thiemann have shown that you can start from this equation and use the full theory to define a quantum horizon by modifying the measure, the Aseka-Lewandowski measure of the horizon, such that your boundary state is a solution of this equation. So what they do, they use the Stokes theorem to rewrite this equation as the holonomy of a link around the puncture in terms of the flux of the electric field through a surface which is enclosed by this puncture. And this equation becomes this, takes this form, where it's clear now that there is a symmetry which has been broken, which is the for example, if you go to the U1 case, the U1 symmetry which encodes the different morphism is broken, in the sense that now when you change two puncture with each other, the state is not invariant anymore. So there is a breaking of the symmetry, but there is a residual discrete symmetry, which is obvious from here, because you see that you now, if you add to m, m is the magnetic moment of the puncture. A multiple of the k is the Church-Simons level of the theory of the boundary. If you add the multiple of k, this state is again invariant. So there is a zeta k symmetry left, which is encoded by this the spin, the m in this case, of the puncture. And again, this is a charge that you can detect by an analog of the Aronoff-Bohm effect. When you go around the puncture, you see there is a conical singularity inside. So these are the kind of information that lives on the horizon. Now, I want to study the last phase of the evaporation process to see what happens to the singularity. So I will now take a definition of quantum mechanics, which is very general, and it's compatible with all the different proposals, some of there is in the literature. So I will define my quantum mechanism by taking a spin network and dividing it in two parts. I will define the bulk of my black hole as a connected region of this graph, which means it's a finite collection of vertices and edges. And on the boundary is given by all the edges, which are only one vertex inside and one vertex outside. So now, what one do is to trace over the graph inside, because as I was saying before, there is a weak interpretation of entropy, of Bekesian entropy, so I don't want to count degrees of freedom in the bulk, so I basically trace over all these degrees of freedom. This corresponds to reducing the graph in the bulk as a big intertwiner, plus some petals, where those petals basically represent the fact that the topology of the graph is not necessarily trivial, and if this is not if the topology is not trivial, then you don't just get a single intertwining, but the graph inside is more complicated. However, this is not going to be very important, so you can also not forget about this. The main thing is that now my quantum state is given by a huge intertwiner with all these links that come out of the boundary, of the surface. Now, if I implement the dynamic I described before, so every step, basically what happens is that one puncture disappears, and I create a new petal on the spin 1/2 inside. And I can implement this dynamic as close as I can to the Planck scale. And I arrive to a point where I have created n minus 2 petals inside, and I have only 2 links left. Now, if I try to eliminate all of them, I see that the dynamic forbids me to do that. I will always remain with one link with spin j equal 1. This is the smallest configuration that my quantum horizon can take. If I try to implement it after this, I will not be able to kill this puncture. So the operator is bounded from below.
Why j equal
1? That's because of the gauge symmetry of the horizon. It has to be an integer. I'm looking at the smallest configuration I can get. So if you look at this, well, what is this object? This is a remnant. It's a massive remnant. So there is in the bulk, you have this huge intertwiner, which tells you that there is a big volume inside. And the horizon is a Planck-scale object, but it's not zero. It doesn't disappear completely. And OK, so the reason why, basically, I cannot shrink complete the horizon is because when I act on 2 spin 1/2, I cannot have this transition here. And this is not just a property of the Tiemann regularization, but it's a more general property. It's due to the 6J part of the Hamiltonian constraint. In particular, this is something that you would get also if you use the spin from amplitude to compute this transition, like if you have your boundary, which is crossed by these two links here, and then you try to implement a transition, a move in which you create a new link inside and you want to kill them, you will see that you cannot kill both of them. So somehow it's a more general property than just the kind of regularization that you choose. So some comments now. This notion of local energy given by the area seemed to provide a basis to have a microscopic derivation of first law, because so this is what this notion of energy is telling you, that the matter, the flux of matter leaves an imprint on the horizon and change the area of the horizon. Okay, so how can you interpret this at the macroscopic level? So you know that matter gates of freedom live on spin network links, and it's somehow natural to expect that when there is a flux of matter inside black hole, new links will be created on the boundary state. And this means that so there is a way for the boundary to keep track of the entropy that it gains when there is some flow of energy inside. Of course, this is an heuristic description because one needs to have a clear picture of how matter coupled to gravity in the LKG picture, but somehow it seems that it's a plausible explanation for the first law. And for what concerns the second law, so now this is what I was mentioning before. You see, I described the evaporation process by I kill one puncture on the boundary, I create a petal inside, and my rust will shrink. So I expect that the radiation emitted is entangled to this new link that I created inside, because now this is a degree of freedom that I don't have access anymore from the outside. So it's a bit of information that I've lost. And the hope is that if I associate a notion of entanglement entropy to this new petal that I've created, this would be will allow me to compensate for the degrees of the area of the black hole and allow me to prove a quantum version of generalized second law. And this, I think, is extremely connected with this picture of LQG entropy, black hole entropy as entanglement entropy. I think it's really the relation between the Boltzmann interpretation, the von Neumann interpretation of the entropy can really become crucial for in this framework to prove a second generalized second law. But there are works by Levine and Ternau where they associate the notion of entanglement entropy to this kind of petals that you have inside your configuration of a quantum horizon, which might be useful for this kind of argument. But I don't know yet if one can actually prove such a thing. Okay. So what about information paradox? All right. So we saw that the spectrum, it's our addition is a discrete spectrum, which means that if I ever observe this spectrum, I will be able to recover the boundary data. Namely, I will be able to read these numbers here from the spectrum, and I will know what is basically the configuration that I had on my horizon. And on top of that, I have that the final state is not singular anymore, but there is a massive remnant which forms, which somehow it's very similar to the picture of a horn-like geometry of Wheeler Banks, the notion of bag of gold, because inside this REM there is a huge now volume, so there can be it can be a new universe inside somehow. Now the question would be, does this remnant decay or is it a stable remnant? And so the way that this remnant can decay is, for example, if the matrix of freedom can now couple again to the spin network outside. But in order for this to happen, I need some non-local effect now. I need some links inside, basically some non-local links in my graph inside, such that now I can couple again by action of the dynamic near the horizon to the spin network outside. And this is something that has been studied by Li and Futini, and they study the notion of disordered locality, so how if you have these non-local links, if they are killed or not by the dynamics, and they show that in fact they are not, you can have these non-local links even in states which somehow encode semi-classical geometry. Still, you can have these links. So
something I don't understand: if you, in your previous discussion, it seemed like you were assuming some sort of Hamiltonian evolution.
Yes.
So if you can go from having links, many links crossing the horizon, to having only one. I mean, Hamiltonian evolution is reversible. Why can't you go back to have having many links crossing the horizon?
So
only one.
To study
why
the
do you need a new kind of
well, this is to I mean what
locality that wasn't so far built in, or are you saying it was so far built in?
No, there was no locality to describe the evaporation process. This is if you want to couple to the degrees of freedom that collapse and for the black hole. These blue lines are degrees of freedom that created the black hole. They are like collapsing inside. It's not those that have created by evaporating the black hole. So I'm saying that if you want to somehow destroy the horizon and break the causal structure of the horizon, you will need to couple to these degrees of freedom, to the external part of the...
You're saying that cannot happen by those kind of Hamiltonian processes that you showed us?
Those are very local actions. So you will need this degrees of freedom to be connected by long links with the external part. Yeah, the thing is that this. No, but these degrees of freedom are those that were collapsing inside, and they can be very far away from still from my horizon.
If I understand the question, it's more like you have an. I mean, you describe an Hamiltonian evolution where the number of punctures goes down, but because it's an Hamiltonian evolution, it goes down and it goes up. Right?
Yes. What I'm assuming is that I'm breaking a time symmetry here somehow. I'm assuming that my boundary states are such that I evolve in this direction only. It's also a choice of boundary state. I can choose my boundary states.
No, the question is either you have an Hamiltonian evolution, in which case, if you go up, you will.
I think the answer has to be, I mean, you're telling a story of which you have some pieces explicitly and some pieces implicitly. And one of the implicit pieces is that the energy once out goes far away so that there's a kind of dissipation, so that the system by itself, this isolated system that you're studying with the Hamiltonian from Gaussian Perez is not a Hamiltonian system because it's subject to dissipation and energy.
But that's the point. We haven't seen the dissipation yet.
So right, that's the part which is implicit. He doesn't tell you once the energy, once the link goes away, there's a little bit of energy that gets radiated far away.
But then do we really need non-local effects to bring more connections across the horizon, or do we just need to send in a wave from far away? Or is that what you're counting as a non-local effect?
Well, here, this is if you want to couple to the matter degree of freedom that fell inside, you need non-local. You can still couple to these petals here, for example. And that's what will happen is that at this point, the black hole will be just fluctuating. Will the cranial puncture destroy new puncture? Cranial puncture destroy new puncture. It's like, but it won't radiate really anymore. It's like it won't really reach the point where you only have probably just one link outside. It will be at this point the a fluctuating thing, but if you want to destroy the horizon somehow and to evolve back, then you need to couple this degrees of freedom deep inside, and that probably would require some local effect like this.
But you just created new punctures in that way. It doesn't look like you destroyed the horizon.
No, if I couple to these ones, I would break the castle structure here. Those are those when I start, I start with a configuration which is a graph inside, which a coarse grain, which contains matter degrees of freedom that form the horizon. And those are the degrees of freedom encoded in these blue petals.
Yeah, but at this stage, is there any physical difference between the blue ones and the black ones?
Well, for example, these petals will all be in the same representation, for example. They'll always be spin one off. They cannot be other representation. And I expect matter degrees of freedom to live on these blue petals here as well.
Okay.
Just I expect them to be like collapsing inside, so like somehow in a region of a space which is deep inside the remnant.
Yeah. But these blue ones are the ones that are correlated with those quanta that went out to. Or which ones are supposed to? No, the black ones are the ones that are correlated with.
Yeah, yes.
It went out to infinity.
Yes.
So you need something from the black one to go to the... You need your non-local thing to go from
No, if the information about the black one, I get them from the spectrum. If I look at the spectrum, I know the information about, I know how many of these blue black petals I've created.
You might know how many, but you'll be missing phase information or something. Because what you're essentially missing, well, let me make a comment after you finish. Unless you're
finished. Okay. Well, I want to say only that the objection to, there's been basically the main objection to random scenarios that you have an infinite pair production rate. And in, this has been somehow.
Can you elaborate on it? Can you elaborate
on this? This is basically, so if you assume that the entropy, it counts the internal degrees of freedom of the black hole, it means that, and you don't extract information before you reach the Planck phase, basically you need to have a huge amount of information inside the remnant if you want to recover all the information, which means that you have all this a huge degeneracy of this state inside. Yes, exactly. Which means that, so even if the probability of producing a, such an object is very low, this huge degeneracy compensates for this probability, and this will affect basically processes in quantum field theory, standard quantum field theory. So basically, you can imagine you have an effective field theory to describe this remnant, and this will enter the processes of your field theory, and it will be somehow a problem for because of this infinite pair production rate that you have. But this is assuming that you can treat the remnant as a point particle, in which the degrees of freedom inside don't couple to what is outside. This is a point of view which has been objected by, for example, Lee and Sabine, and I think that in this picture is even more clear how you cannot really treat this the REM as a point particle.
But yeah, I mean, aren't you, once you have a remnant, you have to be outside the effective field theory frame. Because otherwise, if you have a very massive remnant in a small area, you have a black hole, so you're back to where you started.
Yeah, but you can, since this object is very tiny, you can look at it as a very massive particle.
Yeah, finally, but therefore, its Schwarzschild radius is way bigger than its size, like in a classical picture. So.
Yes, I mean, still, what they object is that.
Why wouldn't they have a Clarkian spectrum?
Because the mass is big.
No, the mass is meant to be small.
It's about, what's the mass of this?
It's the entropy. It's mass.
Oh, the entropy is
small.
The entropy is.
The area is small.
It can't be treated.
The area is small.
The area.
But not the mass. The energy is huge. I mean, if you believe that the energy is the area plus something, then the area is zero, but the something is big. So the total energy is huge. So
I'm sorry, being a bit late, so I see. Could I suggest you go to a conclusion and then maybe some
Yeah, I think this is probably, yeah, this is the conclusion, basically. So, well, just to wrap up, so by providing this interpretation of the first law of quantum mechanics as a fluctuation dissipation theorem, one can study the radiation process of this quantum horizon and see how the relaxation to an equilibrium state is balanced by the excitation of this Planck degrees of freedom. And so this interplay between the micro and the macro levels of description. And this is something that might be relevant for this picture of an emergent space-time scenario in the study of the second classical limit, as, for example, Daniel Oriti and also Lee have pointed out. And also, like, so this final phase for the black hole, somehow it's something that has been speculated to be a component, could be a candidate for dark matter, like when you have this massive remnant left. In LQG, already this proposal has been investigated somehow in a different context, applying some mini superspace technique by Modeste and Fremont Schwarz. And this idea goes back to McGibbon 86, I think. And so the last thing is that this spectrum could be a potential window on the microscopic world, and it could be really a proof of the atomic structure of quantum space. And that's all.
Laurent Raphael already asked a lot of questions, so if anyone else has a question, you better ask before them.
That's what it's related to what we were just saying. What's the mass of the screen at your
This object would have like a Planck mass, basically.
Planck mass, all of them.
Well, it depends what your...
Yeah, or the
you
order.
Go back to your formula where U is S plus square root.
Which one?
I don't know, before, when you talk about... Yeah, no.
Here? No.
Yeah, now you have, yeah, let's say. No, after, sorry. Yeah, this one. So you're saying that, you know, if, let's say if TDS is still the mass.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Therefore, you have that the mass is the area plus something. That's, you know, either you believe that, you know, TS is the area, and therefore there's nothing, or TS is the area plus something, which is this delta area. So So the mass is not necessarily Planckian. You picture the mass is not necessarily Planckian. I'm just saying that using the variation of the total mass.
I don't know what's the.
So you still have delta n equal TDS. Okay? Yeah. Delta n equal TDS. So it means that n is area plus something which is huge.
I don't even see where the m is at. There's only delta, and I don't even see delta. Where is delta? Delta n? Delta
now here it's just delta s. Yes. But then if you keep having that delta n is TDS, so you're still assuming this formula.
You know nothing about the total mass. You only know the variation of the mass.
Yeah, but you see, look at the variation. Now the variation has an additional term, which means that now there's two contributions to the mass. One is area, the other one is the internal structure.
Yeah, but okay, after this process...
After this process is done, the area vanish, but the internal structure is huge. That's this point.
Yeah.
So the mass might be huge. You have two contributions to the mass, area, internal structure. That's the proposal.
I miss an overall constant. So that's, you can always add... remove an overall a constant from that moment.
But that's the point. This constant is the key. It's important. This is the remnant. Otherwise,
I'm saying that the formula doesn't.
You can't remove an overall constant because we know for the large black holes we know the relation between mass and
area. I'm just saying.
So that there can't be a huge additive constant.
So this formula interpreted as that
Laurent is claiming that there's a huge mass, much more than Planck. That's what he's claiming.
So he's saying usually people consider processes where this guy vanish.
Yeah.
Okay? But now he's saying, okay, this is the new formula. The thing that you should have, that's the proposal, is T delta A plus mu n, which means that n is, you know, T plus something which is, that's what I'm saying. If that guy, if you have this variation there, it's part of the mass. So the conclusion that, in this hypothesis, but there might be other scenario, in this hypothesis, the remnant is massive. It has this huge, related to the number of quantum.
Yeah,
so that's the thing. It's not plug,
That's basically a differential equation, and the boundary condition would be that for large masses, the mass is basically the area, right?
So you can decrease the area without changing that. This is the process that people use in Bootstrap.
Yeah.
So when you decrease the area without changing this contribution, all you left over at the end is this contribution. But nothing tells you if this contribution is there. Usually the main thing is that people assume that this contribution is zero. So they assume that when the horizon has shrunk down to zero size, the mass is zero. But that's the assumption. That's the assumption about integrating out the equation without knowing what is the proper boundary condition.
But if this is right, then the whole picture is inconsistent. Because Hawking radiation will reduce the mass and it will reduce the area in a corresponding, when you're in a semi-classical regime, it'll certainly decrease the area by the equivalent amount. So that delta n term, if we interpret things the way you're saying, that delta n term would have to be small during the course of
Hawking radiation. All about neglecting this term. I think that.
So then that term is small.
Hawking radiation process is one where this is zero.
Yeah.
In Hawking radiation. So you only shrink that guy. That's the. I mean, in fact, all the derivations always put that guy to zero anyway.
Then this n will remain small for most of the process.
Zero. Like
or zero, So it has nothing to do with the remnant.
Here you're changing the picture. You're not. I'm considering the evaporation process doesn't take place following Hawking radiation, but using this mechanism of gravitational release of freedom dynamics. And you have those.
But your picture. It doesn't matter where you localize the degrees of freedom, but just consider an evaporating black hole.
Mm-hmm.
After it's down to half its size, what is the change in n in this quantity n? During that process?
Oh, that would be all the n's that you have to throw inside to reduce the area.
Number,
yeah, it's a huge number.
So then it's not consistent to say that the change in mass is given by the change in the area plus this delta n. What's the coefficient of delta n? What is the chemical potential? I don't know what
that
is.
It depends on you, right?
Yeah,
it depends
no,
on the
that's
cost of keeping information in
usually,
the black hole.
That's the point. Usually people assume that the chemical potential of black hole is zero.
Yeah.
So what do
we assume it is zero?
Well, the question is, I think here, the thing is, why do you assume it to be zero? Or instead of putting a question, what is the chemical potential associated with black hole? So,
but
I think that's the main question. Is there a chemical potential? Or why do people assume that?
You are alleging that they are forced to assume that the remnant has a huge mass, much greater than the plot has. I'm trying to understand where that allegation comes from. I thought it was because they neglected this term. So.
No. They assume the mass is a Planck mass usually.
You assume that, but
no, I don't assume that. I was showing the arguments that people object.
I understand, but I thought Laurent was claiming that you had to that the remnant was. That in your picture, the remnant would have to be much
heavier. It doesn't have
to
be
Planck
mass.
Yeah, no, that's why I'm saying that this objection is not really valid
in
this picture.
It's not an objection because the remnant could be much more than a Planck mass?
Yes.
Is that your point?
I'm saying that you cannot treat it as a point particle because of
this.
That's
a different thing, but Laurent is claiming that you have to attribute to a very big mass.
Yeah.
Do you accept that?
Yeah, I agree with that.
So like a solar mass or something like that. For the remnant.
How big is the?
Where is conservation of energy in all of this? I just don't understand how that remotely.
That's the first goal.
I know, but we sit outside and there's a lot of what we think of as the mass of the black hole has come out in Hawking radiation.
So Hawking radiation.
And then in addition, you have this remnant which has.
Hawking radiation, if I understand properly, is a computation where. Hawking radiation is a process, so it's different. You know, maybe the mixing comes from what you describe as a given process, and it's not yet linked to Hawking radiation.
No.
So let me not talk about this process. Let me talk about the process of Hawking radiation. Okay. So the process of Hawking radiation is a process where distance vanishes. Okay. So in Hawking radiation, delta n is zero. So Hawking radiation is a process that changes the area. Without changing, if there is a chemical potential, without changing n.
Canonical ensemble. Basically.
What?
You're in the canonical ensemble.
Somehow, yeah. Assuming this hypothesis, whereas what he was doing is something else where you want to access. So I think the question for validating this picture is, can we find another process that also access this delta n? Right? And then, it's dissipation,
I want to make a slightly different comment. The proof that you sketched of the second law, it seems to me that I've published a proof. It's not really proof because we don't have the full theory of quantum gravity, but it's a proof it's exactly along the lines that you said, I think.
Yeah. It,
is that the, would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
The same,
absolutely.
Which
the same
proof?
You need some entanglement entropy to prove the second law.
What is the which proof?
And that's what your argument, right?
Somehow. No, it's more than that. It's a proof. It's a sketch of how you would actually prove the second law. And in that proof sketch, the assumption is that, I mean, the entropy that's associated to the black hole is the entropy of the external region only, tracing out all the information from the internal region.
Yes.
So is that the same proof that you were
talking
about?
Yeah, somehow dissimilar, because this contribution that you get to compensate for the area would be this.
Well, there's two issues. One is, where is the entropy coming from in the black hole? But the second thing is, why do we know? Why is the general second law true? Why is it that if we take the entropy associated with the black hole,
what's the usual
argument? Add to it to the entropy that we normally associate with external matter. Why should that sum increase?
Can you summarize this proof?
If I can remember it. Yes. I can only summarize it quickly because it's not much more than a summary. So, the summary is, it's based on conservation of total energy for the region outside. For the total energy measures that it's based on the idea that the microcanonical ensemble, if you like to call it, will be preserved by the evolution. And then if you take those two things together, then microcanonical ensemble for the external region will be preserved by the evolution. And if you take, and then the third input is a theorem, which you can prove, which says that if you have any evolution of density matrices that preserves the microcanonical ensemble, then it'll always increase the entropy. So you need to establish, you need a framework in which all those, the third thing is just a mathematical.
So what is
theorem,
the weak point?
But the third, what is this micro, what is, it's basically, what is the Hilbert space that can describe approximately the external degrees of freedom.
That's the thing
which
is not.
Why does the
microcanonical law
to be
preserved
by the external region? Why should it be? Yeah. Well, as I just stated, it's an input, but there was a sort of heuristic argument in that paper why it should be preserved. Which is basically just conservation of energy.
But the thing is that he's saying, I mean, here in this picture, it seems in conflict with. The reason why the area grows is because of dissipation. And dissipation means energy is not conserved. So
not external energy. So we're used to,
so there's some kind of dissipation.
The energy of the horizon or something is what's being dissipated. So it's not, if there's such a thing as energy horizon, which you're assuming here.
Yeah, is this notion.
I don't understand that there is necessarily really something like that, except maybe in some very near to equilibrium approximation. But let's assume that there is an energy of the horizon. Then I think that's not conserved, and that's the shrinkage of the horizon. But the total energy is conserved, is nevertheless conserved. I mean, that must be true, because it's just an identity that you can prove, unless you doubt the classical Einstein equations far from the black hole, then I don't think you can doubt the conservation of the total energy.
What's the definition of energy?
Let's say ADM energy. Any one of these will work. Right?
But there's always a symbol. If you assume conservation of energy, then that time is equal to zero, so you don't have any.
No, that's the energy of the. If I understand, that M is the mass of the black hole. It's not the total mass of the black hole plus the Hawking radiation plus galaxies, whatever may be outside.
It's an isolated system. The universe is an isolated system. That's the assumption.
No. I'm assuming that the black hole
is isolated.
I'm assuming you can make a very big box and put everything.
And there's no heat coming in the universe from the external or going out.
But that looks like a very reasonable. In the context of a black hole evaporating.
So the challenge is to show that there's a fixed inverse space in which that even when the horizon evolves somehow, you're not changing your inputs.
I think
you're just still having one.
Yeah,
Yes, how do we same kind of.
And then the second, what's not unitary, as Laurent is saying, it's dissipative. It's very far from unitary.
Yeah.
The other challenge is to show, if it's a challenge, I think it is maybe the most serious challenge, is to show that there's a well-defined evolution for the external region, which would be true semi-classically, trivially, but true in quantum field theory had a fixed background, trivially. The quantum field theory is causal. But it's not so trivial in gravity. That's related to the issues you're raising about non-local, blah, blah, blah. But if you can, that's the other thing that you need to establish. That there's a well, so there's a well, there's some of Hilbert space you can associate with the degrees of freedom independent of what horizons are present. That the total energy is, that there's a well-defined evolution for this. It doesn't ask what's inside the black hole. And that evolution preserves the total energy. If you assume those three things, then using this theorem, you can prove the second law, the generalized second law.
Mm-hmm.
So it looked to me like that was very along the lines that you were proposing.
Yeah, I mean, that was simply like somehow noticing that this shrink of the area, it's somehow it's given by the creation, the disappearance of data on the boundary. Okay, and these data somehow are correlated with the radiation that you emit. So the question is, if I interpret this as some entanglement entropy injection, can this compensate for the lack,